beached. His bank balance was comfortably in credit. A prolonged sojourn with folk richer than himself had taught him frugality and given him a certain skill in the management of money. He had a modest reputation as a scholar, both in the study of ancient manuscripts and in the history of European painting. He had a generous patroness who lodged him in discreet luxury in an antique tower, which was a dependency of her villa. He had an occupation which taxed him not at all, custodian and conservator of the Palombini archive. Thousands of books, folios, and bundles of yellowing files stored tier on tier in the cavernous vaults, which had once been the stables and the armory of the household guard. In the beginning, the place had been called Torre Melata, because it was built as a watchtower with battlements and embrasures for bowmen and cannoneers. Over the centuries, the words had been shortened and softened to Tor Mirila, Blackbird Tower. The name was apt, because there was a big chestnut tree in the courtyard where singing birds nested, safe from the cold mountain winds, sheltered from the parching heats of Tuscan summer. In the mornings, Pia Palombini would ride up in the electric inclinator from the villa below and settle herself on a chaise longue in a sunny angle, whence she could watch him while he worked and share the tales recorded in the frayed yellow pages, the lawsuits and lecheries, cabals and conspiracies of the high families of Florence, the Palombini among them. In the evening he would dine at the villa in the vaulted refectory where the pine logs blazed in the great fireplace under the carved escutcheon of the Palombini, on a ground azure, across gules quartered with doves volant. Afterwards, when the servants were dismissed, they would make love in the big letto matrimonio, with its brocaded drapes and golden tassels, and its long history of passionate encounters. Sometimes, without warning, Pia would tire of the pastoral rhythm of their days and whirl him away to Venice, to Paris, to London or Madrid, to shop extravagantly and entertain lavishly. It was an agreeable existence, which Mather accepted without guilt and without question. He was good-tempered and good-looking, potent in bed, a well-mannered escort, an intelligent talker, an acceptable guest at any party. He fitted perfectly into the historic role of Damigello, the squire, the scholar in residence, who earned his keep and kept his place and posed no threat to the heirs because Milady might love him but would never marry him. Then one fine spring day, Pia, who had been feeling poorly, went to consult her physician in Florence. He sent her to Milan immediately for extended clinical tests. The verdict was unanimous: motor neuron disease, a wasting and atrophying malady of the nervous system. There was no cure. The prognosis was emphatically negative. All that was in doubt was whether the end would be swift or slow in coming. Either way, the progress of the disease would be inexorable, a wasting of muscles and tissue, a steady failure of the nervous system, an increasing risk that the patient might suffocate or choke to death. When Pia told Mather the news, she asked him bluntly whether he wanted to stay or go. He said he would stay. When she asked him why, he managed the most graceful lie of his life and told her that he loved her. She kissed him, burst into tears, and hurried from the room. That night he had a macabre dream in which he lay shackled to a corpse in the old four-poster bed. When he woke, sweating and terrified, his first impulse was to pack his bags and flee. Then he knew that he could never live with the shame of such a desertion. Indolence and self-interest added strength to the conviction. He was living in a hothouse. Why step out into the winter cold? Pia was lavish in her demonstrations of gratitude. It was not too hard to offer her the simple decencies of tenderness and compassion. At mealtimes he sat next to her, instant to help if she had a choking fit, dropped a fork, or became breathless. As the spasms became more frequent and the wasting more apparent, he would bathe and dress her, walk her in her wheelchair, read to her until she dozed off by the fireside. The women of the household, who at first had called him Milady's lapdog, now gossiped his praises,